Session number 17896, Reel 8.
Did you have any international students at the School of
Yes.
Infantry?
Yeah, we used to, every year we ran what was called the Foreign and Commonwealth course. And I reckon I trained at least three people who overturned their governments in coups. I trained the man who ran the coup in Uganda. And I can't remember the... It was simply awful. No, he was... I don't think he was Uganda, Idi Amin. Was he Uganda? No, it wasn't Idi Amin. But there were six really thick officers, and they all took part anyway in the coup. Maybe been led by Idi Amin. No, I didn't have Idi Amin. And I wish I could remember the others, but they were all from... I think they were all from African countries. Sierra Leone. And then we had Canadians, we had Swedes, Swiss, Irish.
Americans?
Yes, they were always very good value. But normally the Americans came on our proper all-arms course. Now, I remember one American who was giving a lecture to our chaps, and he said, "Unlike your army, we call everyone by their first name, and I call my colonel by his, sir." I have to go back on that. We had Canadians, but the Americans did our proper course. The Canadians did both. They came on both the all-arms course, and they came on this... it was only a 2 weeks Foreign Commonwealth course. In fact, the white chaps used to complain and say that the black chaps kept them back, you know, they were so slow.
You're talking about the African ones?
Yes. Mm. The Iranians were very nice and quite good.
Iraqis?
Yeah. I just tried to think if we had any... I don't remember an Iraqi on a course there, actually. Libyans, yes, who were pretty useless. Israelis, very smart indeed. I had a mixed bunch of DS as well, directing staff. I mean, one of my directing staff was a Canadian, and one was an Australian, and one was an American. Which was great. They all, you know, it was so nice for the students to suddenly get a different sort of voice, you know, and you could see them sitting up instead of a normal British voice droning away at them, you know. You had an American or an Aussie or a Canadian talking to them and really caught their interest. And they were terribly good, very keen. And they, again, had been places like Vietnam and God knows where.
Yeah. So, can we move to
Oman? Yes,
let us. Now?
Yes.
You sure you would like to move?
No, I don't think I will, actually. I'll tell you what I might do, actually.
Button, who are you going for? Right, Oman.
Sorry, I'm not switched on. But,
oh, no, never. Oman, can you fill me in a bit on the reason why you went there?
Yes.
What's your objective?
Well, I tell you what happened was that I was very lucky. You see, I was a lieutenant colonel commanding this, running this all-arms group, and I suddenly was told that I'd been given accelerated promotion to brigadier, and that I was going out to command the Sultan of Oman's armed forces.
Yeah.
And that they consisted of a brigade of infantry, a couple of armed dhows, and a small air force, which at that time consisted of, I think, six piston-engine provosts and four beavers. And they were flown by either seconded regular Royal Air Force officers or contract officers. And my job was the security of the Sultanate of Oman. And that was, at that time, we were still getting incursions into North Oman from Saudi Arabia, not from Saudi Arabians themselves, but they housed people who had fought the Sultan in the Jebel Akhdar campaign. a man called Suleiman bin Himyar, and two brothers called Ghalib and Talib. And they were in Saudi at Dammam. And also people coming in from Iraq, dissidents from Iraq. And then, of course, we had our main thing, which was the rebellion in the province of Dhofar. I don't know whether you got down to Dhofar, did you, when you were in Oman? You would have. So
I
you
got down to Salalah.
Yeah. Well, you will then know that that massif there, which gets the monsoon for several months of the year, that was really where the Dhofar campaign was fought. So I had a war in Dhofar, and yet I couldn't move my soldiers, too many of my soldiers, away from the Sultanate itself, because I would expose the Sultanate to the danger of dissident groups coming into the north of the area.
Now, the dissident groups were after the leadership of Omar.
Yes, they would like to have toppled Said bin Taimur.
And who was backing them?
The Saudis and the Iraqis at that time.
And the rebels in Dhofar were backed by the Marxist South Yemeni government.
That's right, and then later by China and the Soviets.
Now, the reason they sent a British officer out to command them was why?
Well, I was purely taking over from another British officer. What happened was that the Sultan's armed forces were formed, I'm not sure of this, but I think about 1958. And the Jebel Akhtar campaign was fought and really largely won by the SAS. But it was SAF was commanded by a fellow called David Smiley, who was a Royal Horse Guards chap who'd been both in the commandos and the SAS and behind the lines in the Yugoslavia, was a very tough, excellent soldier. And he was a full colonel, and he commanded. He handed over to a chap called Hugh Oldman, who'd commanded a British infantry battalion in Normandy during the war. Then he'd commanded a battalion of Arabian levies in Aden Protectorate levies, and then he'd come and as a full colonel to be CSAF, as they called it, Commander Sultan's Armed Forces. And he handed over to a chap who I knew all about, but I hadn't met, because he'd been in the commandos like me, called Tony Lewis, who was a highly decorated and excellent commando leader during the war. And then they had raised an extra infantry battalion. And therefore it had become a full brigade. And so they decided that they would have a brigadier to command it. And in fact, there were three infantry battalions. The senior one was the Muscat Regiment. And they wore a red Balmoral with a red bobble on it, because the Cameroonians had fought successfully in the Jebel Akhtar campaign, and the Sultan was so delighted with them that when he formed the Muscat Regiment, he decided they would wear the same headgear as a Scottish regiment, except in sultanic scarlet. So they wore this.
And they were Omanis, were they?
They were Omanis and Baluch. The force was both at that time. Then there was the Northern Frontier Regiment, who wore a green beret. And then there was the Desert Regiment, the one that had recently been raised, and they wore a sand-coloured beret. And then there was the Oman Gendarmerie, which was another battalion, but they were officered by ex-British colonial police officers in general, plus one Gurkha. Again, all contract officers. And they held, or they had forts all round the border of Oman, between us and the Crucial States and Saudi. Then they had all the things to support it. They had force medical service, they had force electrical, mechanical engineers, first force signals, and so on. And then there was this navy at that time, which was two dhows. In fact, it was only one dhow when I got there, and then I got another. And they could each carry half an infantry battalion. And then they had the little air force. And
but the overall policy was that Oman should not fall into unfriendly hands.
Absolutely, yes.
Its command on the Straits of Hormuz.
And the oil.
And the oil, yeah.
Which had just been discovered, but everyone knew that there was oil, as you know, oil in quantity there.
So you had to go out and organise these forces into a coherent national defence force.
Yes, yeah.
And
well, they were, really, they were organised as such. I never thought that sufficient care was paid to the Dhofar campaign. To me, it was quite clear the moment I arrived there, that was my priority. I had to get Dhofar won as quickly as I could, if I could. And I found that we were so poor. There was a British subsidy, and I never knew how much it amounted to, because they had a man, the defence minister, was a contract officer who was a sultanic brigadier, British chap, and he held the purse strings. And he had to hold them. I mean, he couldn't afford to squander them. He was a man I liked, but I never could really get through to him the seriousness of Dhofar and what could go wrong there. And if we didn't deal with it quickly, it would gradually get out of hand.
Now, there was a British subsidy at that time.
Yes.
The oil fields hadn't really got going.
No.
There wasn't much income coming there.
There was no income.
No.
And not only that, but when the oil did start to come, Harold Wilson cut off the British subsidy before the oil income was coming. And he seemed to think that the Sultan would borrow the money. And, of course, he misjudged his man. The Sultan had raised his country from bankruptcy under his father to solvency under himself. Very wise husbandry. And that, I know the Consul General warned the British government that this man will never borrow, but they cut off the subsidy. So, and even when we pulled out of Aden, they wouldn't give us a single bloody thing out of the armory or the arsenal there. They made us pay for everything. Thunder flashes, blank cartridges. You know, I mean, you'd have thought that when they were pulling out, the fighting that was going on, the fact that the Arabs had actually fought the British and so on there, you know, the army was rebellious, everything else. But we were up the creek without a paddle until money started to pour through, and it did not come through in my time at all. So it really was on a shoelace, the whole thing.
So, I mean, how was this money raised if the subsidy failed and the oil money wasn't coming in? You still had to pay your troops.
Yes, we did. And that was the money that the Sultan had amassed.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, what little we got from the fishing industry and selling vegetables and so on was all very paltry compared to it. No, he had to use his own resources.
Now, the sort of incursions that were going on were rather similar to those in Borneo, except the topography was vastly different. I mean, you had
trails,
did you, where they were coming in, or what?
No. You see, the border was absolutely wide open. I mean, really, apart from... We had a fort at a place called Rakhyut, and the border there just was open desert. I mean, you could have marched 10 divisions over that border. There was nothing to canalize them until you got to the mountains where the war was really fought. But once you got into the mountains, there were trails. The main place where the enemy came from was called Hauf, and it was on the coast. It was a small village. And that was their sanctuary. And that's where the rebels really were virtually based. And we weren't allowed to go and take it out. I mean, I could have taken Hauf out, British government, political. We were not allowed. It would have been an act of war. I mean, they put their heads in the sand, as far as I could see, about the fact that the Yemenis were supporting the Dhofaris. And if they had, I mean, I do see actually the political side. If we had knocked out Hauf, there would have been Britain attacking South Yemen. I think Nasser was still alive then, but North Yemen had had the Egyptians in it. They certainly had the Russians in it. And before you knew where we are, I suppose they would have said, we've had half the Arab world against us because we had attacked a poor little Arab country. So I couldn't take half out. And the trouble was that the terrain is so thick. I mean, some of the rock is like walking on lava that has melted into shapes that were so sharp. They cut your boots off your feet. The thorns that you had to go through was a real thorn jungle, that they literally ripped your shirt and your trousers to pieces. They knew it backwards, of course, because they were Dofaris. They lived there. We didn't. I mean, my men were Omanis from North Oman and Baluchis from Baluchistan. So, you know, it was a hell of a job to get them to know the area, and they would never get to know it the way the Dofaris did. And I reckon that in all my service career, the best users of ground I've ever come across were the Dofaris. They were tremendous. I mean, you know, they'd suddenly, it was so easy to be surprised by them. They were really quite incredible. I mean, they moved soundlessly. Their tactical sense was very good. At first, they were not awfully good at shooting, but once the Soviets had given them AK-47s and Katyusha rockets and things like that, they became, you know, a formidable foe. Thank God they didn't have aircraft. And, of course, the sort of country we had there was not a country where you could, well, you could get an armored car up somewhere, but, I mean, you had to protect it, and it could, and they put mines down. It could blow up on a mine. It was very much an infantry war, and we were lucky enough to have a mixed battery of artillery, which included 5.5 medium guns, 25 pounders, and we got some little mountain guns, 75 millimeter screw guns, and we got our air force, and the provosts could carry bombs, rockets, and of course they were armed with machine guns. And they were eventually, in my second year, replaced by strike masters, which could carry more, and which were very good as well. But when I got there, for example, I found that the beavers were painted white with the sultanic emblem in red on the wings. I mean, can you imagine flying over the enemy with a thing like that? None of the vehicles were camouflaged. They all had their windscreens in, which meant that they reflected the rays of the sun, which was always shining, or the rays of the moon. There were so many simple things that we've learnt in Malaya, in Palestine, in Cyprus, Kenya, everywhere. You do not advertise your presence, you know, and there are all the basic things which had to be started all over again. Sandbagging the floors of vehicles and so on because of mines, avoiding anywhere that mines were likely to be, and trying, on the few tracks there were, you know, you would try and drive off them on the verge or somewhere, or off the verge, because the verge could bloody well have mines as well. But we learned, really, we had to sort of relearn everything, and this is where I was so lucky that I'd served in a number of counterinsurgency campaigns, and I could see at a glance these basic things which had to be put right. My men were wearing plimsolls when I got there, brown plimsolls. And the first company that I looked at in Dofar, they were tied on with string, some of them. Some of them got no backside in their trousers, shirts all ripped to pieces. And the only thing that was really well done was they looked after their weapons brilliantly. And that was the only thing. And I had my first audience with the Sultan. And I thought, well, he's not going to like me very much. And he said to me, well, what are your first impressions? And I said, well, I really like your men. I think they're great, both the Arabs and the Baluch. And you've got good British officers in charge of them. I said, that side is first class. They know how to look after their weapons, and they know how to look after their vehicles. But I said their footwear and their clothing is appalling. They haven't got enough ammunition. And they've... you've given them these old 303 rifles. You know, you've really got to update everything and modernize what you've got. So really, that was the start of the thing. That, and there were no plans at all to take on the enemy. All they did was, there was a convoy that would come from North Oman to Salalah, and they drive down that one road. And when they came to, Christ, what was it called now? Bugger it, I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name. It had been an old station, an oil company station, and I'll think of it in a minute. But once they got there, you were then into enemy territory. And the road ran up a ramp, which was made of railway sleepers, and they would, the enemy would demolish that ramp every now and then, and then ambush the people while they got out and tried to sort things out. I found these convoys were driving with their canopies down, so the chaps inside couldn't see a bloody thing. Once you got them up and you got the windscreens off and you covered the rear lights with Hessian so that when you put the brake on, you didn't give away yourself by a light, and you had fellas sitting under the canopy if you happen to be in the time of the monsoon, and if it wasn't monsoon, no bloody canopy on at all, and everyone looking as if they were going to shoot back if you went near them. You know, we then stopped having trouble going up and down, and of course you had to picket the heights on both sides of the road so that the enemy couldn't shoot at your convoys going through. But you had this convoy coming down, and all they did was they would get it ambushed and they'd lose a few men. And that they did nothing. They were utterly passive. So I managed to get a good battalion commander. And I said to him, I want you to be thoroughly aggressive. I couldn't move more than one battalion there. Sultan wouldn't allow me to. He was so worried about incursions coming from Saudi Arabia and coming from Iraq. And he was my commander-in-chief. And I said, you know, sir, you're quite wrong. You ought to send everything down there. But he didn't know me, and I could understand that. At that stage, he didn't know me enough to have confidence in me. So I had to make do with that, and then I fiddled people. I had a guard regiment as well. I forgot to mention that. And I made a company up of mainly Vickers machine guns that I found in the fort where my headquarters were. At Beit al-Falaj. And I had a machine gun platoon, Vickers platoon, because there were huge distances to cover there, and Vickers was ideal for it, you know, across the wadis and so on. And I had a company of them, and I sent them down, and I took over the defense tasks with them. And therefore I said, there's no excuse for the battalion not to go out and take the war to the rebels. So, you know, in other words, to get an aggressive attitude to it. Then I, without telling the Sultan, I sent a troop of guns down there because I didn't need them in Oman. I could have got them up if I wanted them. So I sent down, in fact, I sent all the guns down there apart from two 25-pounders, which I kept up north. And I sent all my strike aircraft down there, and I kept a couple of Beavers up because I had to use them for sort of logistic flights up in the north. And I also sent a troop of Oman gendarmerie down there as well, again from taking over some of the garrison jobs so that I could have more people out on the Jebel. And then after a bit, when he got used to me, I then persuaded him that I could send another company from another battalion down there as well to get more soldiers on the ground. I badly needed helicopters. Because the limit of an operation was the amount of water you could carry when you were out there, because there was no water unless you went down the bottom of a wadi. You go down the bottom of a wadi, you find the enemy up above you, you know. So 5 days was the limit. I said, this is no good. I said, how am I going to get casualties back? You know, I'm going to lose men's lives who were carried back on donkey back. 5 days, that man's not going to be alive when he gets down onto the plane again. And I need a helicopter to get him out immediately, and also from a morale point of view. Oh, God. And we had all these problems. We had no proper force medical service. All our casualties, severe casualties, had to be flown to Bahrain. And to do that, we had to get the RAF to come and collect them and then fly them to Bahrain. We obviously needed a decent military hospital and so on. And so anyway, gradually we built up a medical service. Thanks to Pat Waterfield, this defense minister, who was called the military secretary, I managed to get two Dakotas, which helped in air trooping. And it also meant we could fly wounded and badly injured up to Bahrain to the hospital there. You know, all the time the enemy were being re-equipped by the Soviets and by the Chinese. And their numbers were building up. And the British government wouldn't send me, they wouldn't send me helicopters, or I asked for them. I asked everyone, the director of military operations. I'd come home on leave, I'd go to the war office, as it then was, and I'd said, Christ, can't you send me out some helicopters? It'll be good training for our people. I know you may lose them, but all the rest of it. But, you know, these are our friends, our allies. You've sent me out to command them. I need helicopters. I need a field surgical team to deal with my casualties. I need the SAS to try and win the hearts and minds, because the Sultan had no time for the Dafaris. He used to say to me, there's an old Dofari proverb, an old Omani proverb, if you meet a Dofari or a snake, tread on the Dofari. I mean, that's his hearts and minds. By the time I'd finished 3 years there, the enemy numbers had increased, their armament had increased, but at last I'd managed to get through, thanks to Rowley Gibbs, he wasn't my boss, but he was commander of British Forces Gulf. We did not come under him, but he was a great friend. He said to the Sultan, look, this chap, you must listen to what he says. And he said to the British government, look, you've got to listen. And then they authorized a field surgical team. They authorized a battery of artillery. They authorized the SAS to come out to me. And the Sultan bought the helicopters I've been asking him to buy for 3 years. And also the British light gun, which we could carry under helicopters. But it took 3 years to get that. And by then, you see, the war had gone up a ratchet or two. And so the Jordanians then came in, and they provided a special forces regiment, I believe. And then the Iranians sent a brigade of the Imperial Iranian Army. And they sent Air Force and so on. So by the time the war ended, I mean, there were an enormous number of troops. I also raised one more infantry battalion before I left, called the Jebel Regiment, who wore a grey beret.